This is Macro Voices, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 419 was produced on March 14th, 2024. I'm Eric Townsend. Former Goldman Sachs partner and current Veriten partner Arjun Murthy joins me as a first-time interview guest. Arjun is a high-level energy market strategist, and we'll discuss his outlook for where energy markets are headed in the coming energy transition.
And I'm Patrick Serezna with the Macro Scoreboard week over week as of the close of Wednesday, March 13th, 2024. The S&P 500 June futures up 237 basis points, closing at 5232. While the primary trend is mature, the bull trend continues to be intact. We'll take a closer look at that chart and the key technical levels to watch in the post-game segment. The U.S. dollar index down 54 basis points, trading at 102.79. The April WTI crude oil contract up 75 basis points, trading at 79.72. We'll take a look at that chart in the post-game, and Eric will have the EIA inventory data. The April RBOB gasoline up 431 basis points to 266, a breakout to new month highs. The April gold contract up 102 basis points to 2180, a breakout to all-time new highs. Copper up 491 basis points, trading at 406, highest closing price since April of last year. And uranium down 943 basis points, closing at 8310. The correction continues since its February 1st highs. The U.S. 10-year Treasury yield up 9 basis points, trading at 419. And the key news to watch, this Friday's Empire State Manufacturing number. And next week, we have both the Bank of Japan and Bank of England monetary policy statements, the FOMC press conference on Wednesday, and the global manufacturing and services PMIs. This week's feature interview guest is Veriten partner Arjun Murthy. Eric, why did we invite Arjun as a guest this week?
Well, Patrick, Arjun famously made the super spike call for oil prices to go from $50 to over $100 back when he was at Goldman Sachs, and that call proved right. His convictions aren't as strong in the short term now as they were then, but he'll have plenty to say about energy markets and what's happened to them in the wake of climate and ESG trends.
Well, Eric's interview with Arjun is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's your host, Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Arjun Murthy. Many of you know Arjun's name as a former Goldman Sachs partner. He's now a partner at Veriten and very much a energy markets expert. Arjun is kind of famous for having made the famous super spike call when oil was at 50 bucks and he said it was going to 105. And sure enough, that's what happened. Arjun, let's talk big picture, oil market, energy transition. A lot of people have convinced themselves that, you know, it's all over for the oil market because nobody's going to need it anymore. I don't see it that way. How do you see it?
Erica, I actually have a very similar perspective in the sense that there's this idea that people know for sure that oil demand is going to peak at some point in the next 5, 10, maybe 15 years. I don't think there's a decade, let alone year, where anyone can at this point know when oil demand is going to peak. And I spent a lot of time talking about there's the lucky 1 billion of us, those that live in the US, Western Europe, Canada, Japan, Australia, New Zealand. We consume about 13 barrels per capita. The other 7 billion people on Earth use just 3 barrels of oil per capita, and all of them aspire to the types of living standards we have. And I think, is all of that going to be oil use? No. But the idea that we know today what are going to be the displacement technologies, I push back hard on that. And I think there's a pretty strong outlook for oil demand, again, looking out for the, frankly, for the foreseeable future.
Now, we're talking about oil demand. It seems to me like maybe the more important question is not even oil demand, but the reaction function of what's going to happen as a result of the declining investment in the oil patch long term, because so many people have convinced themselves that oil demand, as you say, you know, people think it's going to go away in the next few years. If it doesn't, as you and I think it won't, what is that going to mean in terms of the investment that hasn't been made? What could that mean for available supply? How would that affect prices? And if it turns out that you and I are right and we end up with, oh, we're going to need oil longer than we thought, how long will it take the industry to recover from what might be a supply deficit because of bad planning?
I mean, right now we're in this world where there's, from a policy standpoint, this is especially true in the rich Western world. We see it clearly in Western Europe. We see it in Canada. We see it here in the US, where there's an overarching focus to solve too much carbon emissions. And I think, Eric, I've listened to your podcast. It's a real pleasure to be here. Yes, there's a need to deal with this stuff. But I think the policies right now are focused on that's all we're going to solve for. And I think there's this false notion that we know what can replace all the uses of oil, which of course are far more than just driving our car. And even that part of it, I think we can question whether EVs, as an example, are really a 100% solution or just a portion of the market. And so when you have this dynamic where if you're an investor, and I grew up, you know, at Goldman Sachs dealing with institutional investors, prior to 2020, that previous decade, it was really tough decade for profitability. So if you're a traditional investor, you say, hey, this industry had really poor returns on capital for over a decade. And if there's some uncertainty due to all that I'm hearing about oil demand, then why do we need to bother investing in the sector? And I think these things are starting to not be true, meaning we're getting the signs. Eric, as you know, the IEA called for 2019, and I think even BP had this, that 2019 was going to be our peak year and that post-COVID, we'd never even get back to that level. Well, those forecasts have already been pushed out to 2028 or 2030, and I think they're going to continue to get pushed to the right. But the market hasn't quite caught up with this idea that the outlook for the sector, I think, is healthier than it was last decade. And these cycles are very long term, 10 to 15 years up, 10 to 15 years down. We're coming off a really tough period last decade. We had a couple good years coming out of COVID. Some people thought that was artificially goosed by Russia, Ukraine, and it's going to be volatile. I think we're in maybe year two, year three of a period where sector profitability is going to be better, but there's still a lot of skepticism and doubt. And it is leading to, I guess I'd say at this point, an overdependence that shale will always be there. It has been over 90%, as I know you know, Eric, of global oil supply growth over the last decade. And I think the idea that unlike at any point before in my career, people are not trying to find what's next. They're presuming that at some point we're going to have peak demand or a plateau and perhaps even a decline. If that turns out to not be true, I think the question is what comes next and when are people going to start looking for it?
Well, that's exactly the issue. And something that I think a lot of people really don't understand or appreciate is back in the early 2000s, a whole bunch of people talking about peak oil got all worked up thinking there was going to be a crisis. And they have since been just ridiculed as, oh, nobody's ever gotten anything that wrong. They were totally all wet. They didn't know anything. Well, really, what happened is they had their story pretty much right. What they didn't anticipate was the shale revolution. And the shale revolution is the only thing that stopped the global energy crisis that those guys were predicting from happening. Now, shale has been amazing. It's utterly astonishing what the U.S. oil patch has accomplished. But if we didn't have the U.S. oil patch making up for declining production around the rest of the world, we would have a global energy crisis. So the question I have to ask is, okay, they've been doing an amazing job. I think they've exceeded everyone's expectations. How long can that last? How long can we go before the shale plays run out? And when they do, I mean, if there's something that comes next after shale, I'm not sure what it is. Obviously, there is something that comes next. It's deep water offshore. It's Arctic exploration and so forth. But those things are very expensive, and I don't think they have the potential to deliver the kind of volume that shale has delivered, do they?
I think that's right. And I guess I'd say that we all have to be humble in our shale forecast. So if I go back to my time at Goldman 2012, 2013, when shale was first emerging, to varying degrees, we had some growth expectations for the next several years. And it was always sort of 3 or 4 or 5 years out, we had shale slowing and then rolling over. And of course, that when does shale peak and roll over has kept getting pushed to the right, such that here, even in 2023 last year, shale grew by about, in round numbers, a million barrels a day, well above people's beginning of year forecasts of about half that amount. And so I think we have to be humble. On the other hand, shale, like any resource, is not regenerated. And I think what really concerns me most is there's been a real give up. And it's not just investors. It's the companies as well. Throughout my career, companies have always been trying to figure out what is next. And if you go back to that 2000s era that you referenced in the opening, in that time, when China started coming on post the WTO acceptance and we started having really good developing market growth with continued OECD oil demand growth, everyone was trying everything. Is it going to be Deepwater Gulf or Africa or Brazil? We tried, people wondering about the Russian Arctic. They were wondering about oil sands. We're trying a whole bunch of different things. And you know what we weren't trying was actually shale. Now, we ended up having the shale gas revolution first in the 2000s. And I still remember Mark Pappas standing up at our Goldman conference in Miami declaring sometime it was 2010 or 11, the next big thing is going to be shale oil. And we, EOG, are going to fully transition from a shale gas company to a shale oil company. But the industry had spent 10 years ramping CapEx and trying to figure out what's next. What are they doing now? You're seeing mergers and consolidations that consolidate positions and might get some more efficiencies. It might allow productivity gains to perhaps continue longer than those that think shale is going to peak next year. I think shale can still grow at some couple hundred thousand to maybe 400,000 or 500,000 barrel a day level per year for the next several years. But that's a far cry from saying we can easily grow 1 million barrels a day and account for all of oil demand growth into perpetuity. And again, we can be humble in saying we've all gotten wrong this sort of shale is going to mature and roll over forecast. But at least in past cycles, we've always been trying. And I'll say not just investors and not just policymakers, but the companies themselves are not going out and trying to figure out what's next yet. We don't have major exploration going on. Oil sands in Canada, huge potential opportunity that maybe is starting to get some gurgles of new life with the Trans Mountain expansion that's about to come online. But where's our deep water exploration cycle? Where's our trying new stuff cycle? And maybe it just was such a tough last decade profitability-wise that the world's not ready to accept that we can start a new investment cycle. Maybe there's still too much skepticism about oil demand. Again, as those forecasts get pushed to the right, as we see places like India, Southeast Asia, and the rest of the world move up their energy and economic S-curves, and with it will come energy demand, and a good chunk of that's going to be oil and natural gas. There's going to be a need to meet this stuff. The world hasn't started trying yet, and it's really just a matter of time before that comes home to roost.
Now, let me just ask about the other side of this equation, because as you say, it may be difficult to continue this growth in U.S. production where every year we're adding, you know, another million barrels a day. That's been necessary because the rest of the world's production was declining by a million barrels a day, and we had to make up for it, and we did make up for it, and that was great. Is there any reason to think that the rest of the world can make up for it if the U.S. can't? Is there anything I'm missing there?
I've never thought the world was short oil potential. It does require actual dollars to go in the ground, you know, and so huge issues related, as you well know, to geopolitics. You know, Venezuela used to be over 3 million barrels a day. They're now under a million, thanks to President Chavez and his successors that have really eviscerated that oil industry. But it's not like the oil's not there. And so we might be waiting a long time for a better government or a healthy situation to arise. But the world isn't short resources. It is short the desire to invest. I think there's large parts of Africa, which are still prospective. Again, Canada is a hugely untapped type area that has growth potential. Alaska is an area that, for whatever reason, has this sort of environmental overlay that is hard to understand. It is a critical strategic resource for our country. As the Arctic warms due to both climate change and other reasons, it's going to open up. And we know Russia is going to go and try and develop their portion of the Arctic. I think a big question is going to be, can they do that on their own? Well, they're certainly going to try. Why aren't we trying to do that with our companies that are involved with Alaska, either currently or in the future? It really is one, but we're not trying. And that is what is going to change. Now, it's going to be two or three or four more years of good returns on capital before people get excited. That's probably somewhere in there is the answer, but there's going to be a need to actually spend money. So I don't think we're, quote, running out of oil, but it does take actual spending.
Now, there's a view that I don't agree with, but a lot of people do, and I think that it's affecting a lot of investment decisions, which is, look, you guys keep worrying about this oil thing. The climate community has already got this under control. There's going to be a lot more investment in solar. The price of solar is coming down. We're building electric vehicles. We really are going to eliminate that demand because we're moving to electrifying the economy, and we're going to do it all with renewable green energy. Is there any room for truth in those statements?
I mean, so the idea that we are going to, quote, electrify everything, which I think is one of the taglines, people who are most passionate about the climate use, but somehow do it only with intermittent renewable energy, I just find, frankly, preposterous. So it's not that there's no room for solar and wind. There absolutely is. We are going to need some form of backup or baseload. I know, Eric, you've had some great podcasts on the nuclear sector, especially those ones around year end. That is going to be one of the solutions out there. Natural gas is going to be part of the solution. I think if I was to speak positively about solar and wind, and this gets to electric vehicles as well, if you are a region like China that is short crude oil and or generally short crude oil and natural gas, you're going to try your hardest to limit your future imports. So if China has gone from basically being balanced in oil supply and demand to now importing 11 million barrels a day. And Eric, they've only gone from 1.5 barrels per capita of oil demand to about 4 barrels. We are at 20. Canada's at 20. South Korea's at 20 barrels of oil consumption per capita. Europe's about 10. The rich world's at 13. So yes, China's not poor. And there's certainly pockets that are rich. But overall, it's sort of a middle income economy. And we can certainly debate, have their demographics changed? Is it too authoritarian? Is there going to be some, you know, diminished GDP outlook going forward? But they're certainly going to try to be rich. If you are China, you are motivated to try and limit your future oil imports. And can you do that with electric vehicles? It's about a quarter of the demand barrel globally. It's about a quarter of the demand barrel in China. That will be one of their solutions. They are highly motivated to do that. I don't think that experience in China, where to some degree you have the domestic critical minerals processing capacity, you have BYD and the battery manufacturing capacity, you've absorbed or made deals to get all the raw materials that go into it. That is very unique to China, including their authoritarian government, which can force this upon their consumers to some degree. They're going to be highly motivated to not go from 11 to 20 million barrels a day. And can you imagine, we're in a world where the U.S. has gone from importing that amount of crude oil to basically being balanced, especially when you add in Canada. And so the geopolitical implications of this, I think, is the driver that marries the climate objectives with some notion of decarbonization. If you are a developing country, it's going to be true for India. It's going to be true for large parts of Southeast Asia. If you are not long crude oil and also natural gas, you're going to try and figure out new technologies. The tricky thing from the climate standpoint is, I know you know, Eric, is China and India both have a lot of coal. And so you can see it in their actions. And there's lessons for us, right? China is, of course, now half of global coal demand. Coal demand hasn't peaked. It's making all-time highs every year. We've never used less of anything, including wood and biomass, right? So this energy transition, the idea it's going to be quick and easy, is a pipe dream. The idea that you're going to do it only with renewables is also a pipe dream. But if you have solar and wind, and if you're a country like China or India, once those solar plants are up and running, solar farms, et cetera, it is a domestic resource. So for those that poo-poo solar and wind as just being an intermittent resource that greenies like, I think for the developing world, that especially if they're not long natural gas, it is going to be a complementary fuel to their coal growth. And I think it's trying to understand the geopolitical drivers of these new technologies, I think is going to be the more important driver than just trying to solve for a singular variable like carbon, which is what I think you hear in most of the rhetoric today.
You mentioned nuclear, and you're right that I'm the world's biggest advocate for nuclear energy. But look, it's not able to solve any problems in a short time frame. Unfortunately, in the West, we still have nothing but conventional nuclear technology, where Americans take about 7 years to build a nuclear power plant. South Korea is much more efficient at it. They can do it in 4 or 5 years. But still, it takes several years to bring new nuclear capacity online. Now, China is going gangbusters. They are moving very aggressively on both conventional and advanced nuclear energy. And I think that's because they see exactly what's coming. But the West isn't. And although I'm extremely excited about small modular reactors and, you know, thorium and all of these other exciting technologies, they're still several years away. So there's nothing that can, in the next 2 or 3 years, help anything from a nuclear standpoint, other than it's definitely the right long-term solution when we get our act together, which we haven't yet. So that's not going to be the solution. I agree with you that wind and solar are a worthwhile technology, but look, we spent $4.6 trillion in the last two decades alone on renewable energy, primarily wind and solar. So far, they've made great progress. They've improved those technologies tremendously to the point where they've now solved exactly 3% of global energy demand, no more than that. We're not going to, if we do have an oil and gas energy crisis at some point because of lack of investment, we're not going to suddenly just build a few more windmills and solar arrays and solve it. And I don't see what we are going to do to solve it, because if we get into that situation where we've underinvested in oil and gas because everybody convinced themselves it was going away, it seems to me that the time lag, once you figure out, oops, we made a mistake, let's invest in oil and gas, how fast could we fast track bringing things online? Some of the drilling technologies have improved in offshore. I see that the Guyana development, at least until they got into a spat with Venezuela, was moving faster than I originally thought it was going to. So is there an out if we suddenly figure out that we really do need more oil and gas than we thought? How many years does it take to kind of get our act together and get supply catching back up with demand?
Eric, there's no free lunch. And in energy, nothing happens quickly, right? It's why these cycles are long-term in nature, 10 to 15 years up, 10 to 15 years down. We can say this one sort of began in 2021, and maybe we're in year three of it. But again, unlike past cycles, we're certainly not really trying to grow, especially our oil supply. We are going to grow LNG in this country. I think, I've spent a lot of time talking about the development needs of these sort of, I call them the other 7 billion people on Earth, and that's soon to be 9 over the next 30 years. Extra 2 billion people, mostly in the developing world. And how do you solve for their desire to move up the energy and economic S-curve? And these are all long-term questions that need to be addressed. But we now have a near-term development in this country, and it's going to be true around the world. And I apologize that this has become a buzzword, but artificial intelligence and the data center growth that is going to imply suggests that we are, for the first time in 20 years, going to have positive load growth. Positive power demand growth in this country has been flat to maybe up 0.5% over 20 years. And these numbers are inflecting positively. They're inflecting positively also because of electrification and electric vehicles and all the sort of climate-y kind of goals, but they're getting turbocharged. And what is interesting to see is to see big tech absolutely freak out about power availability and reliability. And it gets to the point on solar and wind. Again, it is going to be part of our mix. It can be a distributed generation source, which has its points of attractiveness. It can be a domestic resource, because once it's up and running, it's not subject to an embargo or some other, you know, external adverse actor negatively impacting the supply. But no one who is running a data center says, well, I'll just run it, you know, when the sun is shining or the wind is blowing, right? It's absurd. And there's a recognition amongst big tech that I'm going to call it, and I apologize for the phrasing, but they're sort of fluffy, feel-good, net zero by 2050 promises. When you think about how important technology is to our economy and our iPhones being such a huge component of energy demand, not dissimilar in aggregate to what gasoline demand is. And you think about all the other compute power that's coming. They now recognize, look at the deal that Amazon signed with Talon Energy for a data center next to a nuclear plant last week. Huge deal, hugely important. And while, again, I'm an energy guy, when energy guys are talking about AI, be careful. maybe there's too much hype to it, but you are seeing in these markets some of that demand inflect positively. And there's going to be a recognition that you need to have reliable power. And so these things are long term. But the mood around nuclear has gone from it's not green and not part of anything, and we need to continue to do away with it, like we saw in Germany, to now recognition from some of our most important companies that we need to study this and we need to be real about our goals. And I think that's a really important big shift, that when you combine that with the needs of the developing world, what I've called a messy energy transition, it's been my motivation to have sort of unretired after a decade of doing board and advisory work to have started this Substack called Superspiked. It's about discussing this messy energy transition narrative. The world is getting a wake-up call, and I do think big tech in this sense has a chance to help turn this conversation and narrative in a more positive direction. And so when you talk about long lead times in nuclear, not that Amazon can fix those lead times, but you get more than just the energy folks talking about the need for reliable, available, affordable energy that's there 24/7, 365, we have a chance to at least move the needle forward in a better direction.
Are there any other energy sources we haven't talked about? I mean, you're the big picture strategic thinker. It seems to me like nuclear is the right solution. It's just going to take a while to bring it online. And we haven't even made the real commitments yet to bring it online. So, you know, it's quite a ways off. Wind and solar will continue to grow, but, you know, it's taken 25 years to get to 3%. So, you know, how and it'll go faster in the future, but how much faster? I don't see anything but more oil and gas supply being brought online to fill in any deficits. And it seems like that investment, as you said, is not happening. Am I missing something? Is there any other Hail Mary pass here?
There's no Hail Mary pass. There's no short term. Here's how you fix it. It requires time. It requires investment and it requires a policy framework, especially from countries like the US. We have so much to offer the world with our substantial oil and gas resource, our refined products that we now export to the world, our LNG that we are. Despite this pause, which is an unfortunate development, we are growing our LNG exports to the rest of the world. We also have technology to export to the rest of the world. Tesla, whatever one thinks about its equity, as a car manufacturer, it sells 1.2 million vehicles. That's a luxury vehicle, as we know. I personally drive a Tesla. I enjoy driving it. It is not 100% solution, but it is an example of a successful technology that I think can be exported to the rest of the world. And there are lots of other examples, folks in Palo Alto, Austin, Houston, studying and developing all sorts of new technologies. And they're going to be a motivation, again, for these countries to figure out, hey, I don't want to be a hugely dependent on Russia or Saudi, or maybe you don't want to be dependent on shale if you're China, as an example. You are going to try your hardest to figure out new technologies to displace energy demand going forward. But I'll tell you what's a scary stat. You look at Norway, a country of about 5.5 million people. They are now about 85% electric vehicle sales. That's all through policy. I think as a percentage of their fleet, they're still working through it. It may be over 20% of the fleet right now. But over this period of time that they've gone from essentially zero to within a decade, 85% sales of EVs, total hockey stick, total home run dream that every climate activist would have totally signed up for. I mean, I was shocked to find out that their oil demand in aggregate is actually up slightly over the same period. And it's because all the other uses continue to grow, petchem, diesel, LPGs, and so forth. And so EVs address about a quarter of oil demand. And the idea that this is a ubiquitous solution everywhere, we can already see in the United States, the nature of driving is very different. In Norway, gasoline's about 16% of its oil demand barrel. It's down to 7% with the EV push. Other uses have offset that. In the US, it's 45%. We have a suburban, as you know, Eric, suburban, rural type environment here. You drive everywhere. You know, unless you're in New York City, where you, if you're not scared, you may still take the subway. By and large, you're driving everywhere. So the idea that we're going to force or that somehow we're going to have 100% EVs is ludicrous. So when you talk about new technologies, I do think hybrids have a chance to make a dent. And so from a policy perspective, why would a state like California say we're going to have 100% mandate, 100% EVs by 2035? There's nothing that is just about that when you think about how expensive EVs are for most of the population. Hybrids can put a dent in it. And I think there's no silver bullet. It's going to be all of the above policies, all of the above technologies. And I think at some point, it is going to have to be a motivation to say, we have substantial resource still to be developed in the US, both in oil and gas, but also Canada and including Alaska. And do we have the type of policy framework that doesn't say, we hate you oil companies, and you know you're going to grow despite us because the state of Texas kind of gives you a little more leeway than we do. How do we create a positive investment and policy environment to encourage more development so that we can meet the world's energy needs? We're not there yet. I think we're moving that direction. And again, oddly, and it's more for power generation, but I think the involvement of the technology sector and recognizing really the shortfalls of our current policy and sort of climate-only mindset, I may be being optimistic or hopeful that will be a catalyst to having a better conversation going forward.
So assimilating all of these ideas, what's your outlook for oil and gas energy prices over, say, the next decade?
My framework at the time being has been, I've used the phrasing super volatility, rather than super cycle. And I think there's a couple things that I take pause, and I'm a regular Macro Voices listener. So, you know, I'm a fan of Jeff Snyder and yourself and many of these other guests you've had. The economic uncertainty that we have in China, Europe, and even the United States at this moment keep me from using the super cycle language. That coupled with the fact that I am very humble to the fact that we have all underestimated, all oil equity analysts and commodity analysts have underestimated the resilience of shale. We've spent already enough time talking about the fact that that won't go on forever. But at least over the next couple of years, if we have some shale growth, Guyana and Brazil are ramping up, and you're getting some continued growth out of Canada, that might be enough to match, I'll just call it a low-end oil demand forecast of about 1 million barrels a day of growth. If it turns out, and even myself who said, hey, I don't think there's a decade, let alone year, where oil demand globally is going to peak, I have acknowledged or thought the OECD may be more mature. But even there are signs that even I, who am generally sort of, quote, bullish on oil demand, have been too pessimistic. And it's quite possible that even in the rich Western world, where we should actually be having declining oil demand for efficiency and EV type reasons, that we could actually be flattish. And this is a time, Eric, as you know, where no one thinks we have a booming economy. No one thinks Europe has a booming economy. And even China, no one thinks they have a booming economy. And yet we're going to might be as much as 1.5 million barrels a day of oil demand growth. And so I've been using super vol language to recognize the fact that there's a sort of, let's just call it, recession or lackluster economic uncertainty, and that will, I think, whip back and forth between trending towards 50 on oil and then going above 100. I think if the oil demand numbers start coming in closer to 1.5, if we end up flattening OECD demand and we don't have a decline there, and if shale matures finally, then you start sowing the seeds for, let's just call it, that next super cycle. You know, in that sense, when you look at past super cycles, typically, it's been a 5 or 10-fold increase in oil price, not a 20 or 30% increase. Now, I'm mercifully out of that game of publicly forecasting oil prices, but you don't have super cycles. You don't end up getting to where you need to destroy demand by having modest increase in the oil price. That's not the nature of these things. You tend to have 5 or 10-fold increases. They may not last forever, but that's the type of upside volatility you get to the extent we don't get back to investing in our oil business in particular.
Well, let's talk about that not investing, not just in the oil business, because, you know, look, we've got our opinions, but other people have different opinions. But I think almost anybody who's a sane analyst looking at energy markets has to agree that we're setting up for an energy deficit in coming years. And what seems to me is different this time, and I don't understand why, is you would expect a lot of speculative investment in energy. Now, maybe some people don't agree with you and me, and they're going to say, no, it's not all about oil and gas. It's all going to be nuclear. Well, look, we're not seeing speculative investment in developing nuclear power plants. Yes, there's a lot of speculation in uranium right now, but that has to do with a supply squeeze and some geopolitics and other things. It's not about building more nuclear power plants. Likewise, you don't see much speculative investment at all in the advanced nuclear technologies, which is where I think, you know, the world is really headed. Okay, other people don't see it my way. Well, where are the speculative long energy investors who don't see it my way? What are they investing in? I don't see any real increase, even on the wind and solar side. They've got the sustained climate-driven investment. Who's looking at the coming deficit in energy supply and speculating on it? As far as I can tell, nobody. I don't understand that.
Eric, I don't mean to be flip, but my sense is they're all in NVIDIA, right? I mean, right? And so, like, and I'm respectful of it. The Magnificent Seven stocks, they're exciting. And a lot of those companies have revenue growth. And unlike the dot-com bubble that sort of was at the start of my Goldman career, the current Googles and Microsofts, they are very profitable. So I have a lot of respect for why it's just easier. And now we have AI. I personally believe that is a new computing paradigm that is an exciting area. What we are going to learn, and again, I don't know whether it's going to be next month, next year, or 3 years from now, is you don't have technology without energy. You don't have anything without energy. And I do believe that tech companies are starting to get this. I've been impressed with what Microsoft has done. I think they're the ones who originally had that sort of fluffy promise. We're going to eliminate all of our emissions and all the emissions from when Microsoft was founded to 1976. And they've gone from that, these kind of pie in the sky, rosy scenarios, to like, oh my gosh, simply buying sort of solar offsets in other regions doesn't power this data center. And planting a forest in Costa Rica, which last time I checked was had quite a few trees to begin with, isn't really doing much for the climate anyway. And so now you've seen them sign up for nuclear studies, and you've seen them sign up for direct air capture. And we can still debate the timeframes, but there's a recognition there. Look at Meta, the former Facebook. They've hired my friend John Arnold, who you probably know, a very successful natural gas trader from 20 years ago, probably known more now as an energy commentator, investor. He's on some advisory boards. We were both on a couple of advisory boards together, but they've hired him. I don't think they hired him just because he has some interesting views on how to fix the education crisis in San Francisco. I'm pretty sure it's to have a better understanding of energy. So the sign that the dominant companies in the marketplace today are recognizing this deficit of energy knowledge, right? Eric, I've been doing this for 32 years. I had a great first 22 years at Goldman and a few other Wall Street stops. I enjoyed my 10-year, quote, retirement period where I just did advisory work. But there is, I felt compelled to, I may not always be right. In fact, you can look at my track record. I've definitely made a lot of wrong calls, but I at least know more about energy than what you hear from a lot of our leading politicians and policymakers today. And it's at least a different perspective. It is not pie in the sky, solar and wind and electrify everything with just these two intermittent resources is going to solve all of our problems. And so I think we're not there yet, but I think the needle is starting to move away from climate and CO2 is all that matters, to now recognizing people call it a trilemma. I don't even like that language. You have to, it is a hierarchy of needs. Everyone absolutely needs energy to be available at all times. You don't actually care if it's affordable. You'd prefer it be, but you don't care. You'd prefer it be geopolitically secure. But I always say the worst day of my career was at Goldman Sachs when 9/11 happened. And the next day, I was out buying gasoline that de facto was in part fueled by Saudi Arabian crude oil resources, right? And so you don't even care about geopolitics at the end of the day. Energy has to be there. But there is a potential when you think about geopolitics to also solve our environmental and climate challenges. It's not about ignoring them. It's about understanding what the drivers are. And so I think I will be hopeful and say that how many years of profitability do we need? This is a sector that has 0% return on capital, the energy sector, especially the shaley, oily E&Ps last decade, 0% return on capital. They're now on track to be between 15 and 20%. 2024 should be the third year of plus or minus doing that kind of number. That's a very good level of profitability for some of the leading companies. Their profits are actually competitive with some of these giant technology companies, believe it or not, in terms of a return on capital type metric. And so I don't know how many years of good returns, but what I do appreciate about investors, they will always chase the money. It may take some time. The momentum can overwhelm in the short term, but high profitability is going to be irresistible. And the longer you do not invest, the greater the odds that your profitability stays at a good level, at least at the sector and at least for the leading companies. And I do think people will come back in, but I just can't tell your audience that's going to be next quarter or next month. It might take another year or two.
Based on the lack of investment that we've already seen and the confluence of the various factors that we've already discussed, do these things lead you to the conclusion that some kind of global energy crisis is inevitable eventually? And if so, approximately on what time frame?
I think we're going to continue to bump up against a crisis environment. And so we can say that, the shock to Europe that, hey, guess what? Russian gas is not dependable. And I can't remember if anyone warned them about this, but I know this is not a political podcast, so we'll save that rant. This type of crisis environment, I think it'll be a regular feature going out over the next 10 to 15 years. And you get periods where things spike up. What I think is going to be hard to predict, Eric, is what the exact nature of it's going to be. So I wouldn't have had that, Russia shutting off gas after invading Ukraine was going to cause the equivalent of $500 a barrel equivalent local gas prices in Europe. And so it's hard to predict the exact nature of what happens next. I think OPEC spare capacity is one of the most overstated numbers out there. Saudi Arabia, in the history of the country, has never sustained more than 10.5 million barrels a day. Now, maybe they can do 12 on a sustained basis. They've never actually demonstrated it. And I don't know why the market or observers or politicians take them at their word for what they say their capacity is when there's a huge inherent motivation to overstate it. And again, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they can do a lot more. Why would you run your country or economy on the presumption they are absolutely 100% telling the truth on their spare capacity? And the point would simply be, if we're in a world where shale does suddenly mature, as we spent some time talking about, this idea that Saudi is going to be there to fill the gap, well, yeah, they're at 9 today. They can go back to 10.5. How much CapEx? They just canceled, as you know, an expansion project. And I think the same, you know, UAE has some spare capacity. I think most other countries within OPEC, I'm going to say they basically produce what they can at all times. And so there's just not a lot of cushion in the world. We're generally low on above ground inventories, and we're generally low on below ground inventories, which is your quote spare capacity. And we're at a time where CapEx, despite 3 years, I'm sorry, this will be the third year, of 15 to 20% returns on capital, which is a really good number and is competitive with any sort of history. And it's competitive with other, competitive with the industrial sector, competitive with technology in aggregate. It's competitive with healthcare. It's a competitive number. You're still seeing CapEx for this industry much closer to trough levels than anything above. And if anything, all we're seeing is M&A activity that is, I hate to use the word defensive because they're not all defensive deals, but they're acting like we need to get synergies. We need to get productivity gains. We're not seeing new capital formation. We've seen, especially in the US, big private equity mostly move out of the traditional space and not yet come back. We're seeing public investors trade this sector off of its lows. It was 2% of the S&P at its lows. This sector is energy has generally been 8 to 12% of the S&P. It's up to 4% in round numbers today. So yeah, it's up off its trough. Its earnings contribution to the S&P is 10%. But it's still way under punching its weight. And so we're going to need to see enthusiasm come back to the sector. It's just not happened yet. And I'm sorry. So, you know, every couple of years, I would expect some different area to creep up as being that sort of, could it be a refined product situation? Right now, the market's convinced gasoline's going to plateau due to EVs, especially in China. You know, it might, but what if it doesn't? And what if in a world where refining capacity does not have a lot of excess, you suddenly have some outages? So we don't know the nature of what's going to cause the crisis. It was LNG and gas last time. It could be gasoline next time. And I think that's going to be an every couple year kind of thing. And of course, I'm not a power market expert. That is the next area that is clearly ripe. The idea that we're even going to risk having brownouts or blackouts in our country is insane. And that's not just due to intermittency from solar and wind. That is part of the issue. There's also a lack of investment there. We have shut down existing nuclear plants and gas plants and coal plants, which is fine if you had a whole bunch of new stuff that you were bringing on. But in the absence of bringing that stuff on, it's a recipe for disaster. And I think the power market would be the one to watch. It's not quite like an oil price spike where it makes the headline news, but I do think blackouts and brownouts will make the news, and it should not be acceptable, and it doesn't have to be. Stop shutting down, please. Let's stop shutting down the old stuff before the new stuff can demonstrate that it can be there 24/7, 365, not just some of the time.
Let's talk about the changing strategy of Saudi Arabia. I'm actually working on putting a whole show on this subject together next month, but I was really taken by the recent announcement. For anyone who's not familiar with it, previously the policy position of Saudi Arabia was that their production capacity was supposedly 12 million barrels a day, could be increased to 13 million barrels a day with additional investment. That's what they told the world to plan on. Recently, what they announced is that they've made a strategic decision not to increase capacity. They are going to stay at 12 million barrels a day indefinitely and not increase their capacity. And some people celebrated that as, oh, okay, that means Saudi finally got the memo that, you know, the green revolution is succeeding. I don't take it that way at all. What I think is going on is the Saudis have realized that most of their country's wealth in their sovereign wealth fund needs to be diversified, and they're very actively investing all around the world through their sovereign wealth fund. And I don't think they want to make further investment in oil and gas because the rest of the world has essentially doomed the industry long term. They want to invest in other places. And something I just don't think the world is ready for at all is the day we get to that coming global energy crisis you and I are both think are coming. And everybody says, okay, Saudis, you guys are the swing producers. Come on, crank it up. We got to get you to 13 and a half. Try to get 14 million barrels. And they say, no, actually, we're not going to go from 12 to 13. We're going to go from 12 to 11 because we're going to continue to diversify our investments internationally, and we're not going to make continuing investments in the oil patch. If that were to happen, what would the consequences be? And am I crazy to think that that's a possibility?
I mean, I think that that is a possibility. And I agree with your perspectives that there's a diversification imperative there. I think the exact reasons for why they decided to delay or not go forward with this expansion, as they say, from 12 to 13, but let's just call it plus one. So for me, that'd be 10.5 to 11.5. I think it clearly is a political decision. I think whether it was meant to keep Russia on sides with, I do believe that this idea that Saudi and Russia, at least rhetorically, have been more on the same page since the terrible price war at the start of COVID. That was important to them. Maybe that was a driver. But there's no doubt. I think these Middle East countries are interesting. United Arab Emirates as well. The recognition that they have a huge resource advantage, and that resource advantage can be used to help develop places like China and India and the rest of Southeast Asia. And they're going to do it proactively. But they're also going to do nuclear, as we're seeing in the United Arab Emirates as an example. Saudi's going to try and diversify their economy. I think we'll see how successful that ends up being. There are probably some cultural challenges to how much tourism and these kind of things you're really going to have that I might, you know, be a little skeptical of. But they're certainly going to try. What I respect and appreciate about their strategies is it is outward looking. It is, we have this energy advantage. How do we use it to our advantage to help develop the rest of the world, which is a very different, at least outward sort of statement of values than what we are currently saying in the United States and Canada, which is we need to limit our domestic industry, whether we've been successful or not. We need to yell at them about new developments in places like Alaska and offshore and elsewhere, and we're not going to have lease sales, and we got to, quote, keep it in the ground, and we're not going to approve pipelines, and we're not going to try and accelerate the nuclear permitting process. Like, we're taking the opposite view, when in fact, our oil production is higher than Saudi's. I don't have this stat myself, but someone just told me, if you add up the U.S. and Canada, it's not bigger than the Persian Gulf in oil production. That's a remarkable, remarkable stat. Never mind our LNG exports, which Saudi's going to try and do. Never mind we are leaders, the United States, in innovation and can export a whole bunch of new technology. So the sort of outward focus that a country like Saudi has towards developing the rest of the world, I applaud them for it. I applaud the United Emirates for it. And I do think there's a lot we could take away from that. And hopefully we'll have a chance in coming years to have maybe a more outward-looking view of how we can use our natural strategic advantages for the betterment of our country, the United States, but then to help develop the rest of the world.
Well, Arjun, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. Before I let you go, please tell our listeners a little bit more about what you do at Veriten, what services you offer, and how they can follow your work.
So Veriten, it's a bunch of colleagues from both Goldman Sachs and many people will remember Tudor Pickering Holt. What we do is we help energy companies primarily think through the energy outlook, transition, and strategic type questions. So it's mainly geared to sort of what we call them our partner companies. We don't have a institutional investor type model. We do also have a small fund that focuses on newer technologies as well. I write a weekly blog post called Super Spiked. It can be found at arjunmurty.substack.com. It's also available on the Veriten website, veriten.com, fairly phonetic. And at veriten.com, you could also get our weekly Close a Business Tuesday video interview podcast are the two things we produce. And then I'm pretty active on Twitter, Eric, at Arjun and Murty. As well. But thank you for having me on. As I mentioned when we started, long time listener, first time caller kind of thing. And it is both an honor and a pleasure to be here with you. So thank you.
Patrick Sobresna, Nick Galarnik, and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Now back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Sobresna.
Eric, great interview with Arjun. Now joining us again in the post-game segment is Nick Galarnik. Now let's get to that chart deck. Listeners, you're going to find the download link for the post-game chart deck in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, that means you have not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, and click the red button over Arjun's picture saying, looking for the downloads. Now, Eric, let's start with crude oil and the EIA inventory.
EIA printed a drawdown of 1.5 million barrels of crude oil, Cushing, Oklahoma, drawing down 220,000 barrels. The big drawdown was on gasoline, down 5.7 million barrels, distillates building 888,000 barrels, for a net petroleum drawdown of 6.3 million barrels. Meanwhile, U.S. production ticked down another 100,000 barrels to 13.1 million barrels. Really seems like there's a plateau forming there at 13.3 million barrels. That was the high print before the pandemic, and it's been the high print since the pandemic. I'd be very interested to see if we can get substantially above that at some point. The Keystone Pipeline status has changed so many times in the last couple of weeks, I can't keep track of it, and I admit I haven't been following it as close as I used to when I was trading oil more actively. Suffice it to say that the time spreads were coming off. They're starting to back up again. I'm guessing that's probably pipeline related, but I'm not on top of that news. So far, though, every test of the 34-week moving average just below $80 on WTI has failed. As of the close on Wednesday, we're just barely back up above it. It'll be interesting to see whether or not we can sustain that level and move on to a meaningful rally above $80.
Well, Eric, this morning we do have a breakout above the $80 level. It's still unknown whether they will be able to hold that breakout by the end of the day. But overall, crude oil has been progressing higher, higher highs, higher lows. The bottom really did establish itself in December. It's been trading above its 50-day moving average for over a month and really just needed a breakout out of this trade range to kind of open that upside. At this stage, if the breakout holds, I'm looking for $85 on the upside in the most immediate future. The fact that RBOB gasoline is breaking up, we'll talk about that chart in a moment, I think continues to support that case. All right, let's dive into the equities. I want to get all of your opinions, but Eric, let's start off with you.
Louis Vincent Gabb's words ring true in my mind. It feels like 1999 all over again. It's easy to make lots of good arguments for a downside reversal, but the market just keeps on melting up to new all-time highs anyway. When this happens, it usually continues to melt up for longer than most of the smartest people in the room thought possible, and then eventually crashes abruptly, as it did in March of 2000. For now, we're still in the melt-up phase. I have no idea how long it will last.
So spot price right now on SPX is approximately 5165. We have a call wall above at 5200 and a put wall below at 5100. And the implied move for the April 19th monthly OPEX is plus minus 150 points. Therefore, the upper implied move is 5315 and the lower implied move is 5015. Right now, we have key resistance above at 5200 and key support below at 5100. I'm inclined to think that we see a swing higher, swing low based upon the FOMC, which takes place next week. Powell's commentary will be very, very key in determining where we move from here.
Yeah, when I look at that chart, Nick, we continue to see the same pattern. The price action is bullish. The bulls remain in control of the trend. Higher highs, higher lows. Every dip gets bought. It's an upwards channel that's been in place since January. And the market is relentlessly rising now towards some of these different hourly measured moves that approach 5,300 on the upside. So we have a trend that's in place very strong. On page five, I have where that 50-day moving average is around the 5,000 level. This trend has been so strong that even a 250 S&P point pullback, like you were suggesting, a couple percent, would find support right along an uptrend moving average like that. And so there's a lot of technical damage that has to happen in order to shift this trend. Typically, that is associated with topping formations and other types of things that would be associated with a pivot in the trend. That just hasn't emerged. Maybe next week's news might be the catalyst. Right now, the ascending trend line approaches 5,200. That would be like the first kind of support line that we'll be looking to see if it holds. But right now, we have to respect the prevailing trend, knowing that inevitably that market correction is around the corner. And when it is, I actually think it'll be deeper. It could easily be of the 5 to 10% variety where we could see, you know, 400, 500 S&P point pullback. But there's no sign that it has begun now. Moving on to the NASDAQ, what levels are you watching here, Nick?
So right now, the spot price on Qs is approximately 440. We have a call wall above at 445 and a put wall below at 430. The implied move for the April 19th monthly OPEX is plus minus 19 points. Therefore, the upper implied move is 459, which would mark new all-time highs, and the lower implied move is 421. Right now, we have key resistance at 450 and key support at 430. As I mentioned last week, I'm bullish on certain names, namely Google and Apple, because they pull back nicely off their highs. Right now, Tesla is breaking down and could see as low as 150 in the short term. NASDAQ on Friday had a significant pullback from a high of 975 all the way down to 850, which was a crazy pullback intraday, causing the market to go from green to red. But I think that being selected with the names you choose is very, very important going forward, because certain names are very overextended, while certain names are very undervalued, namely Apple and Google, in my opinion.
It's interesting you mentioned those names, but really all eyes turn to NVIDIA in my mind. If NVIDIA cannot continue its trend and break to a higher high after this pullback, then that will be a huge drag on the entire index. And so over the next coming days, watching whether the bulls actually buy the dip here on NVIDIA and get this north of 920 and get it really running back up to the highs, maybe even testing 1,000, I think that's necessary for this bull trend to continue. Otherwise, it will be a damper on sentiment as well. Nonetheless, let's talk that volatility index trading back on the 13 handle. What are the levels you're watching here?
So right now with the VIX at about 13.5, we can expect intraday moves top to bottom of about 0.85%. Again, I don't see much changes from last week, where we're seeing a lot of put selling on pullbacks and call selling on pops. This should continue into FOMC until we get a clear direction, either up or down. And moving on to page 8 on the US dollar index, what are your thoughts here, Eric?
The big question on my mind this week has been whether or not the second hot CPI print in a row would breathe a new upside enthusiasm into the Dixie, as more traders begin to anticipate the possibility of the Fed's rate cut plans maybe being put on hold until after the election. But so far, I don't see any of that. As Jim Bianco told us, it's going to be June or never for the Fed. And I think the biggest factor affecting the dollar will be how market expectations develop going into the May and June FOMC meetings. I don't see any possibility of rate cuts starting at next week's March FOMC meeting. But if that happened, it would likely bring a lower dollar.
The dollar remains right in the dead center of its one-year trade range. And really, at this stage, I don't think there's going to be any big indication of a dollar move until we get past all the central bank meetings next week. And so really, at this stage, it's just a matter of holding out, seeing whether the 102.5 level holds, which is a Fibonacci retrace level, and whether or not the central banks next week are a catalyst for potentially starting some sort of a trend move.
Now, moving on to page 9, we have the gold futures chart. What are your thoughts here?
The first meaningful correction in the massive bull move in gold is finally upon us. I predicted last month that a second hot CPI print in a row would cause gold to take a nosedive, and that's exactly what's happened. As Patrick said last week, the play here is going to be to buy the dip. The question is how far we have to go to the downside before the bull move continues. To my thinking, the range of possibility is as follows. A correction down to the 38.2% Fib retracement level would take us all the way back down to 2,115, 2,115 on the April contract. And that's as low as I could imagine this correction running, unless there's a surprise rate hike or some other hawkish surprise. The other end of the range is that the bottom could already be in at 2,156, the level that gold touched in the hours immediately after the CPI data came in, and which, by the way, was a perfect test of its 8-day moving average. So my feeling here is you want to try and buy this correction as close to its bottom as you can, with the range of possibility ranging from you already missed it to hold out for 2115, 2115. I can make either argument. On one hand, the slow stochastics are very, very high, very overbought, and have already rolled over to the downside, suggesting a further downside correction still lays ahead. On the other side of the coin, the move up was so exuberant that I see plenty of room for emotion to take us even higher, notwithstanding the worsening short-term technicals. And all it would take is a little monetary policy news in either direction to change that outcome. Patrick, I'm very curious to know your take on the levels to watch and where you would start buying this dip if you haven't already.
Eric, there's a simple rule in technical analysis where what were previous overhead resistance levels now become support. And with the fib retracement level sitting around the 2100 area, I think any pullbacks in the $50 to $100 an ounce area are the tactical buy on dip areas where you have some asymmetry.
Now, Eric, last week you were talking about the buy on dip on these pullbacks on uranium. What are your thoughts here?
I'm still super bullish on uranium, medium to long term, and I'm getting more optimistic that one final push lower to the 200-day moving averages is still to come before this correction is over. Cameco almost touched its 200-day moving average on Wednesday, and Sput put in a new cycle low Wednesday. Several of the other mining stocks broke their 100-day moving averages to the downside, which until now have been holding the market up. And that suggests that lower numbers are still to come. As I've said before, I welcome a deeper correction as an opportunity to buy more uranium and uranium miners at lower prices. And at this point, I'm not in a hurry to rush out and do that. The 200-day moving averages are still well below the market on most issues, and I'm going to wait until we get closer to them before I continue to buy more shares. The potential upside catalyst on the horizon, and it's probably still a couple weeks out, is legislation now being mulled by the U.S. Senate, which would outlaw the import of Russian uranium products. The politicians are just virtue signaling to their constituents, "Teach that stinking Putin a lesson." Well, in reality, the fact of the matter, whether you like it or not, is we need Russian uranium imports more than we need whatever benefit the sanctions would supposedly afford to us. So the Senate legislation has been crafted to allow generous exemptions to keep the necessary trade flowing even after the symbolic gesture of imposing sanctions has occurred. But the fear in the industry, and it's a strong one, is that Putin will respond by saying, "Oh yeah? Well, forget your exemptions. If you want to play this game, we'll just ban all exports of uranium products from our side, and the West will be cut off. No exceptions." If that happens, it will spell much higher domestic uranium prices, and it will cause a conversion and enrichment shortage crisis of epic proportions. In my opinion, the Senate is playing with fire here, and the potential outcome of their arrogance could be much higher uranium prices. But this legislation isn't likely to even reach a vote, never mind passing, for at least a couple more weeks. And during that time, I'm optimistic that we'll see lower uranium prices than we have today, and therefore better buying opportunities.
Yeah, Eric, this pullback on uranium has really accelerated here on the very short term, but it still meets all the criteria of a typical secondary corrective move in a primary trend. And I'll agree with you that this should be bought on dip here, and particularly these levels on the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust, and this one's the one on Toronto. But buy levels are anywhere near this $25 area is a tactical place to put some of that trade on. I wanted to leave it off by looking at the chart on copper. And I've been far more neutral on copper since it's been in that trade range that's been established since the second quarter of last year. And here we are with a breakout now to highs that we haven't seen since the first quarter of last year. And so the big question here is with this kind of China stimulus story coming about, did we see the bull breakout here in copper, and is copper at this stage destined to retest its January highs? It's certainly a bullish breakout, and we want to see if the bulls can now follow through. The most disappointing thing at this point would be if the bulls let the selling give it all back and get it back below the 50-day moving average, but I think that that's an outlier. At this moment, any pullbacks, like we talked about in gold, any pullbacks in copper can be initially bought here with targets to toward the 4.25 on the upside.
Folks, if you enjoy Patrick's chart decks, you can get them every single day of the week with a free trial of Big Picture Trading. The details are on the last pages of the slide deck, or just go to bigpicturetrading.com. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's research roundup.
In this week's research roundup, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview in the chart book we just discussed here in the post game, including a number of links we found really interesting. So you're going to find this and so much more in this week's research roundup.
Well, that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make this program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. That is Eric spelled with a K. And follow Patrick at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend, Patrick Serezna, and myself, thanks for listening and see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.